in excluding him. They would themselves be branded as dastardly hypocrites. Not to have participated, he said, would contradict the principle and purpose of my life. Douglas had lived as a public symbol in America and abroad, but rarely had his physical presence caused such a stir in the house of his friends. Embarrassed, the Republican politicians returned to their rail cars for the ride into Philadelphia. On September 3rd, nearly 300 delegates gathered in Independence Hall for a grand procession, two abreast, through the historic streets of Philadelphia. Having failed to exclude Douglas, most Republicans resolved to ignore him. Awkward and conspicuous, he stood alone as the lines formed. The delegates, he recalled, seemed to be ashamed or afraid of me. The tall brown man with a recognizable silver-streaked mane of hair stood out like the black sheep in the flock. To his rescue came Theodore Tilton, a friend and the editor of the New York Independent. During the parade, Douglas and Tilton's arm-in-arm march garnered tumultuous cheers from the crowds, as well as scowls from some tense Republicans. At 9th and Chestnut Streets, Douglas spied a familiar face in the front line of the crowd. Amanda Sears, daughter of Thomas and Lucretia Ault, Douglas's second owners, stood waving with her two children. Douglas had nothing but fond memories of Amanda's mother. He broke ranks in the march and ran to Amanda asking what brought her to Philadelphia. With animated voice, said the autobiographer, the former slaveholder's daughter replied, "I heard you were to be here, and I came to see you walk in this procession." The simpatico between the two childhood acquaintances, possible siblings, was apparent for all to see. The Republicans' procession became the subject of ridicule in the Democratic Party and pro-Johnson press. Moreover, Thaddeus Stevens did not attend the convention, but was sufficiently irked at what he called the arm-in-arm performance of Douglas and Tilton to complain about it privately. He called the image a practical exhibition of social equality and worried that it would lose us some votes. When he got his chance on the platform in Philadelphia, Douglas took dead aim at any such sentiments that would bar him from political life. For 3 days, Southern and Northern delegates met separately and attacked Johnson and the Democrats. Douglas delivered at least 3 speeches in the packed Union League Hall. Such constant speaking in this pyrotechnic political atmosphere rendered him hoarse by the 4th day. Douglas addressed many familiar themes with raucous humor, the all-important role of the ballot in solidifying black freedom, bitter ridicule of Johnson, and even scorn for allies such as Stevens. Douglas's defense of the patriotism and assimilation of blacks to American culture contrasted with, again, the alleged retreat and decline of Indians. Douglas delivered a lengthy comparative, racialized rant about Native Americans. Blacks had achieved the character of a civilized man, and Indians had not. "The Indian," said Douglas, by one invidious distinction after another, "is too stiff to bend, and looks upon your cities, your steamboats, and your canals and railways and electric wires, and he regards them with aversion. The Indian retreats," said Douglas, "while the black man rejoices in modernity." Brutally ignoring so much history, Douglas claimed that against his people there is a prejudice, against the Indian, none. He complained that Indians faced only romantic reverence, while blacks were despised. It is astounding that Douglas would use race this way, just as American Indians were fighting and losing so many Western battles over their lands, and especially as the federal government, in alliance with Christian and philanthropic reformers, launched the reservation system, as well as the long effort to detribalize Native peoples. The prolonged effort of Bureau of Indian Affairs agents to achieve the forced deculturalization, to destroy the Indian and save the man, of Native Americans on a vast scale was a history very different from the one Douglas used to assert the cause of black rights. The marketplace for racism was diverse and terrifying in Reconstruction America. Even its most visible and eloquent homegrown opponent could fall to its seductions in his fierce quest to be accepted by American civilization. The political context prompted from Douglas a folksy style in which he made himself the central subject. He garnered roars of laughter and applause by announcing that he had brought along an individual that has been associated with me for the last 50 years, the Negro, to which someone in the audience shouted, "Bring your friend with you." He was, he said, the representative of the black race. He scored points far too easily with the scurrilous racial argument that blacks would never die out like the Indian. Douglas could be very funny on his feet. "We ask a right to all the different boxes," he shouted, by which he clarified, "the witness box, the jury box, and the ballot box." "Without these rights," said the orator, "his people would remain in a bad box." Style trumped substance in some of these performances. He even employed a new variation on his Irish joke about voting. "If a Negro sober knows as much as a white man drunk, he surely knows as much sober as Andy Johnson in any condition you may name." His hosts even picked up on Douglas's manner. Theodore Tilton and William Kelly introduced him on September 5th as a runaway slave in the House, who had been apprehended and brought before the meeting as the prisoner at the bar, tried for his crime of wonderful genius. Douglas had become the living exhibit, as well as the ironic relief for some Republicans in Philadelphia. He thought his host's introduction a bit jocular, he said, but had himself set the tone. Not everyone enjoyed the joke. Trouble began on the fourth day when Douglas, Tilton, and Anna Dickinson, a young Quaker orator, entered the hall of the Southern Loyalists. Border state delegates opposed black suffrage and tried to force adjournment, whereas delegates from the former Confederate states, directly dependent on black votes, held out for a suffrage resolution. The decisive moments came when Douglas and Dickinson were called upon to speak. Dickinson, a mere 23 years old and already heralded as the Joan of Arc of the abolitionist platform, urged the franchise for blacks as a major step in human progress. Answering the familiar cries from the audience of, "Douglas, Douglas, Douglas," the word master stepped to the platform and caused a ruckus. "I responded with all the energy of my soul," Douglas later wrote, "for I looked upon suffrage for the Negro as the only measure which would prevent him from being thrust back into slavery." Some border state delegates bolted the convention. Meanwhile, the mass of Southern delegates reconvened the next morning, expressed thanks to Douglas and Dickinson, and endorsed black male suffrage. The 15th Amendment was still 3 years away, but its momentum swung into motion at Philadelphia in 1866. Douglas reveled in the irony, as he put it, of how the ugly and deformed child of the family had won a victory over fear and expediency. He loved how his presence at this center of American politics still seemed to terrify white editors. A New Orleans reporter, worried in the wake of Philadelphia that as soon as Republicans could get President Johnson out of the way, they would secure a Fred Douglas or Sumner in the presidency. And a Pennsylvania editor announced that soon Fred Douglas would be president, with Negro governments in every Southern state, Negro senators and representatives in Congress, and no bar raised against the perfect equality in society and in politics. The former slave was delighted to infest the dreams of anxious whites worried about equality. The leaders of the women's suffrage movement also had anxious dreams in the late 1860s. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony increasingly demanded that the crusade for black male suffrage would now sweep women into the franchise as well. Douglas remained their old ally, dating back to Seneca Falls throughout 1866. He wrote to Stanton in February, thanking her for the launching of the Good Ship Equal Rights Association, a new organization of which Douglas became a vice president, devoted to achievement of universal suffrage. The two pledged mutual support to each other's cause and voting rights. He tried to soften Stanton's potentially volatile sensitivities by telling her there had been no vessel like her since Noah's Ark, and without the women, the Ark would have sunk. But signs of the schism to come emerged everywhere in the wake of the 14th Amendment's inclusion of the word male. In November 1866, Douglas spoke at the convention of the Equal Rights Association in Albany, a meeting called to advocate for equal suffrage provisions for blacks and women in the impending revision of the New York State Constitution. For the audience, which included Stanton, Anthony, Lucy Stone, and a variety of old Garrisonians who supported women's suffrage, Douglas left mixed messages. By every fact to which man can appeal as a justification of his own right to a ballot, he declared, a woman can appeal with equal force. But then he drew historical distinctions. Women should realize the dire urgency faced by blacks, he argued, and wait. With them, it is a desirable matter. With us, it is important, a question of life and death. With us, disenfranchisement means New Orleans. It means Memphis. If woman achieved the vote, Douglas maintained, she could only do so by lifting the Negro with her. As their suspicions grew, Stanton and Anthony wanted to know just where Douglas stood. Anthony wrote to Douglas in December 1866, desiring to know if he would join her in the presentation to the state legislature in January. She urged him to sacredly devote the last of the old and the first of the new year to the work. Similarly, Stanton wrote in January with the same query about whether they would make their case to the state government together. Douglas did not show up at the January 23, 1867 hearing in Albany, where the state senate voted down the women's suffrage resolutions. Soon, an ugly and prolonged breach developed over whether women's suffrage and black male suffrage coexisted on the same agenda. With decreasing numbers of allies, Stanton and Anthony were no longer willing to play second fiddle in the race for suffrage. In their arguments, they aimed both high and low. Their case for women's suffrage stemmed from deep grievances and from a sophisticated argument about the vote as protector of economic, educational, and even personal security in a world that otherwise prescribed a women's sphere. Above all, they demanded equality, not merely in the abstract, but in reality. Their demands became increasingly absolutist, uncompromising. Douglas, too, had often viewed the vote as protector of the safety and aspirations of blacks, but Stanton in particular resorted to indefensibly racist rhetoric in advancing the case for women over uneducated men of any race. In 1868, she took a stand against a man's government, citing a history of war, violence, conquest, acquisition, slavery, slaughter, and sacrifice under male leadership. She believed a man's government is worse than a white man's government, by the strange reasoning that it would only multiply the tyrants. Then Stanton aimed at racial comparisons and forced Douglas and others to react. By denying American women the vote, politicians, Stanton contended, degraded their own mothers, wives, and daughters below unwashed and unlettered ditch diggers, bootblacks, hostlers, butchers, and barbers. But she did not stop there with her invidious class and racial ethnic slurs. She asked her readers to imagine Patrick and Sambo and Hans and Young Tongue, who do not know the difference between a monarchy and a republic, who never read the Declaration of Independence, making laws for refined, educated Anglo-Saxon women reformers. Douglas, too, had used his drunken Patrick jokes to argue for black suffrage. But Stanton and Anthony had crossed some lines. Many in the women's rights movement were also disgusted when Stanton and Anthony denounced the Republicans and allied with white supremacist Democrats in 1868. They did so by welcoming the support of wealthy racist merchant George Francis Train, who funded the new journal Revolution, Stanton's ideological mouthpiece. Throughout this ugly debate over suffrage, Douglas maintained a remarkable grace and even friendship with Stanton, although not so with Anthony. A good deal of romance has evolved in popular memory about Douglas and Anthony, since they both resided in Rochester for so long, and in modern times a touching monument was erected of the two, depicting them having tea together. At the May 1869 meeting of the Equal Rights Association in New York, Anthony blew up and forced Douglas into an impromptu debate. 90% of the large and raucous audience were women. Women had to stop stepping aside for the black vote, Anthony insisted. Men cannot understand us women, she shouted. They think of us as some of the slaveholders used to think of their slaves, all love and compassion, with no malice in their hearts. But watch out, she warned. Women were fed up with being dependent and demanded to earn their own bread. She chastised Douglas for arguing that black men needed the vote because their situation was more perilous than that of women. Anthony slashed away, challenging whether Douglas would ever exchange his sex and color with Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Douglas tried to answer, but Anthony drowned him out with the assertion that votes for men but not women would send fugitive wives on the loose, just as fugitive slaves traversed the landscape before the war. Declaring, "We are in for a fight today," Anthony declared for the most intelligent first in voting, and therefore, let woman be first and the Negro last. The 15th Amendment had severed the women's rights movement for the foreseeable future, with Stanton and Anthony fighting in isolation for their absolute principle. Douglas gave as he took. He objected to Stanton's use of such words as Sambo, although he tried to do so with humor. He fiercely resisted the equivalence of women's plight with that of the freed people. When women, because they are women, are hunted down in the cities of New York and New Orleans, when they are dragged from their houses and are hung from lampposts, when their children are torn from their arms and their brains bashed out upon the pavement, when they are in danger of having their homes burnt down over their heads, then they will have an urgency to obtain the ballot equal to our own. Things only got worse as the 15th Amendment passed Congress in February 1869 and became the template of disagreement. Stanton predicted that equipping black men in the South with the franchise would culminate in fearful outrages on womanhood. The imagined demon of the black rapist crawled into the suffrage debate, courtesy of the leader of the women's rights crusade. As her biographer contends, Stanton was an absolutist more than a strategist. Unrepentantly, she preferred diehard principle to political maneuver. She even came out against black men's votes if women were denied, which is what the 15th Amendment did. She proclaimed black women better off in slavery than in freedom. Their emancipation is but another form of slavery. It is better to be the slave of an educated white man than a degraded, ignorant black one. In her opening address at the May 1869 convention, she envisioned the nation heading toward national suicide and woman's destruction under manhood suffrage. The 15th Amendment would create government where clowns make laws for queens. Stanton's racial and social hierarchies allowed no concern for the complex logic of Reconstruction politics. Her racial and class code language cut to the bones of those who had spent their lives fighting for black freedom. The utter insecurity of black communities in the South simply did not interest her. She demanded the individual woman's right to vote, regardless of social context or violence. Trying to sustain civility, Douglas, who attended most of the women's rights meetings, pushed back. Countless times, Douglas gave his full support to women's equal right to suffrage. By modern standards, he could seem rather patriarchal in his language, contending that white women had always been advantaged because their husbands, fathers, and brothers are voters and could protect women's interests. His humor at women's rights gatherings may sometimes have fallen flat, as in Rhode Island in 1868, when he remarked, "I cannot say much about women's wrongs. The men love them too much to wrong them." He claimed as well that in every debate with a woman, he had got the worst of it. He thought women had an inside track to the vote over black men because you, white women, are beautiful and we are not. Douglas abhorred, however, Stanton's and Anthony's embrace of Train and the Democrats. He was disgusted by their racist rhetoric. Most important, he had learned an abiding pragmatism from 2 decades of radical activism, war, and revolution in pro-slavery America. He wished the 15th Amendment had gone further in outlawing qualification tests and in extending the vote to women. But this was hardly the first time Douglas accepted half measures from his fellow Republicans while working for a longer revolution. He knew that political rights derived from politics and had learned it the hard way. In March 1869, Douglas had a chance encounter on a train in Ohio with Stanton and Anthony. It was still 2 months before the bitter breakup. They managed a friendly ride as well as an earnest debate. Anthony extended her hand, although it would be one of the last times for many years to the man Stanton described in a great circular cape of wolfskins. Stanton's remembrance was respectful, but foreboding. She observed that Douglas had a most formidable and ferocious aspect. In correspondence, Stanton wrote with sharp wit, "I trembled in my shoes and was almost as paralyzed as Red Riding Hood in a similar encounter." Douglas left her feeling reassured by a gracious smile and hearty words. The Black Orator, seeking new vacations, never truly reconciled with Anthony, who remained embittered. But he did maintain friendly professional relations with Stanton in the coming two decades. Douglas attended many women's rights conventions in the years to come, and in 1870-71, he wholly endorsed the effort for a 16th Amendment for women's suffrage as a robust, natural right to govern themselves in every way a man could. At the same time, he counseled women to have the patience of truth while they advocate the truth. The Big Bad Wolf remained obsessed with political rights, chalked up at best a partial victory, and moved on to new crises, national and personal. Douglas's personal life was now fraught with many conflicting pressures. Throughout the Reconstruction years, the patriarch found himself over and again adjudicating rivalries and feuds among his children and their spouses. Everyone in his extended family struggled with money and livelihood, and Anna, still the center of the home everyone returned to in one way or another, suffered from recurring illnesses. The itinerant lecturer needed to make a living on which all around him depended, sustained what his son Charles called the hard and killing tours. A long-lost sibling from slavery days on the Eastern Shore was about to arrive wondrously in the Douglas's lap in Rochester, with his own family of former slaves in tow. Julia Crofts and the old editor sustained their transatlantic correspondence, full of nostalgia for past dreams and labors, assurances of their mutual deep trust, and Julia's worries over Frederick's occasional despondency. Clearly, Douglas could still confide in his old comrade, whatever the distance or subject. And Odalie Ossing, the adoring, opinionated, voluble, hidebound salon host in Hoboken, remained a presence in his life. She sustained strong views about how her occasional companion conducted his career, his family, his finances, and his political and religious ideas. Repeatedly, she also informed her sister in Italy of her desire to return to or visit Europe, but could not imagine how I'm supposed to manage to untie myself from Douglas. If anything, Othello had too many occupations. Chapter 23. All the Leeches That Feed on You. Though I am not rich, I am not absolutely poor. I am working now less for myself than for those around me. Frederick Douglass, May 6, 1868. In midsummer 1867, Douglass experienced another reunion with a slave sibling. His brother, Perry Downs, formerly Perry Bailey, born in 1813, the oldest son of Harriet Bailey, arrived in Rochester with his wife, Maria, and four children to reconnect with his famous kinsman. During the 40 years of separation, Frederick had only heard that Perry had been sold south to Louisiana. In a letter sent to Douglas the previous February, written by an intermediary, Perry reached his brother with the amazing story that Perry's wife had been sold to East Texas, and that he had gone to find her. Perry had labored as a field hand in cotton and sugar. In the wake of emancipation, he and his family, somehow surviving as a unit, made it to New Orleans, where a Reverend T.W. Conway supplied them a note of introduction to J.J. Spellman of New York City. Through Spellman's aid, Perry's family found their way to the Hill in Rochester and the Douglas household. An emotional, if strained, reunion took place there for the next 2 years. Perry's family was illiterate, their habits and values bred in decades of slavery in some of its worst precincts. Nonetheless, Douglas was initially deeply moved by his brother's arrival, although the house now overflowed with needy guests. In September, Douglas wrote to Theodore Tilton saying that he, and thereby Anna, had been keeping a kind of hotel all summer. His poor brother Perry, after a bondage of 56 years, deeply marked by the hardships and sorrows of that hateful condition, and after a separation from me during 40 years, suddenly appeared, as if he had lived on another planet. Douglas spent much of the summer working with Perry to build for his family a snug little cottage on the property. Douglas wanted his long-lost brother to spend the remainder of his days in peace. Douglas wished Perry's old masters could see their former slave now, strong and hopeful, taking care of himself. The younger brother and author pondered the possibility of writing Perry's story in a narrative, or perhaps even a novella. But if slavery were not dead, said Douglas, and I did not in some sort wish to forget its terrible hardships and horrors, I would try to write the narrative of my brother's bondage. Douglas's life was likely too hectic and his travels too frenetic to write that book. Such a past was not easy for him to retrieve, and he admitted so in a widely reprinted statement. Let the old system go. I would not call its guilty ghost from the depths into which its crimes have cast it. I turn gladly from the darkness of the past to the new, better dispensation now dawning. Douglas was never good at forgetting the past, but looking closely at what slavery had done to the bodies and minds of Perry and his family made Douglas yearn for release from its clutches. Shortly after Perry's arrival in Rochester, Douglas took him on the road to an August 1st celebration in Watkins, New York, at the base of Seneca Lake. No record survives of Douglas's speech that day, but he no doubt introduced his brother and told his story. Perhaps Douglas could speak what he did not choose to write. Tilton published Douglas's letter and called the episode a beautiful and romantic chapter in a great man's life, and proof that truth is stranger than fiction. The problem, though, was that Douglas's kinfolk were truly strangers, especially to his own grown children, who had been born in the free North. With time, the reunion in Rochester became anything but romantic. From his new post in Washington, Charles wrote to his father in confusion and resentment, grumbling, I don't understand in what way those people you have at home are related to you. Is it that Mr. Downs is your half-brother? From what I have heard of their conduct, I should be afraid even to have them in the same neighborhood, and more especially when you are away in the winter months. What Charles heard likely came via his sister, Rosetta, who lived with her family nearby in Rochester. When the cold months arrived, a frustrated Rosetta wrote to her traveling father about the struggles of Perry's family in surviving their first Rochester winter, and that they might soon be moving back south. So widespread was the story of Douglas's taking in his brother's brood, that when British friends sent money, he promised to use it to support the new additions to his burgeoning household. The homestead on South Avenue also had another adopted stray. In Washington, at the end of the war, among the thousands of freedmen who trekked into the city as refugees, was a 13-year-old former slave from Georgia, Henry Struthers, who had the good fortune of meeting and befriending Charles Douglas. Obtaining his father's approval, Charles sent Struthers to Rochester, where he would be employed as a gardener among other tasks, and, most important, treated as a fictive son. An English friend wrote in January 1868 of how Julia Crofts had kept a network in Britain informed about Douglas's extended family. Your life, wrote Mary Carpenter, has been full of strange adversities, sad partings, wonderful meetings, bitter work, and thrilling joys such as we scarcely know anything of except in books of fiction. It all did seem rather romantic from outside the circle of reality. Douglas wrote to another English friend in May 1868 about his financial situation with at least partial honesty. So far as my own circumstances are concerned, I am successful, far more so than I ever ventured to hope. And though I am not rich, I am not absolutely poor. Then came a genteel understatement. I may say that I am working now less for myself than for those around me. Indeed, Douglas labored, especially through his lecture tours, to financially sustain a growing clan of struggling, discontented, feuding siblings and their families. A bitter and enduring dispute grew in 1867 and lasted for many years among Charles, Rosetta, and her husband, Nathan Sprague, with Odalie Ossing piping in with toxic opinions. To say the least, Douglas himself was caught in the middle of some ugly crossfire. In these years, Lewis attempted without much success to run a school in Maryland. With his brother, Frederick Jr., he moved out to Denver, Colorado, in 1866 and 1867, and tried his hand in a variety of businesses, including a laundry and a lunchroom. The two brothers also spent a stint working for a mining company. Douglas's old friend, H.O. Wagoner, who lived in Denver, assisted the brothers in getting started. He wrote to the father a revealing observation. "Lewis, I take to be a young man of strong, clear, good sense. He seems to drive right ahead at the object aimed at. Frederick, however, seems to be more cautious, reflecting, hesitative, and, as you say, practical." The financial and professional struggles of his sons were a constant worry for the elder Douglas, who for much of the rest of his life frequently extended them loans. Back in Rochester in the winter of 1867, Charles tried to manage the patriarch's endless correspondence and speaking commitments. In February, Charles wrote to his father, who was on tour in Michigan, at length of the cost to gravel the road in front of the house. Charles was desperate for a secure job that would allow him to provide for his pregnant wife. He had married the 18-year-old Mary Elizabeth Libby Murphy, September 21st, 1866. Meanwhile, Rosetta, her husband, and their two babies had tried to make a go of it by buying a farm near Rochester. The venture failed quickly, and they sold the farm in spring 1867 and moved back into the city. Nathan wrote to his father-in-law of his desperate financial straits. Rosetta, too, wrote of the travail of moving and complained about anxiety over their dangerous Irish neighbors. Douglas gave Rosetta and Nathan a loan of what had to be several hundred dollars, with which the son-in-law bought a hack and a handsome span of grays. For $640, $200 down, and a payment plan of 18 months, Nathan and his hack, Rosetta proudly, if awkwardly announced, were on the stand every day. But White Hackman insulted and threatened Nathan as a competitor. The business, like everything else the hapless Nathan attempted, did not pan out. By April 24th, Rosetta reported an outrage on Nathan's hack. Nathan could not overcome Yankee racism or his own demons. A young mother with a husband who could not effectively provide, Rosetta shouldered many burdens. She seemed to resent managing her father's letters, but in a mixed tone of embarrassment and gratitude, she wrote Douglas obligatory notes. "Father, I cannot thank you too much for your kindness to Nathan and myself, and I can assure you Nathan is grateful and proud of your good opinion of him." Such opinions would not last for long. Worse yet, Rosetta monitored the spirits and physical health of her mother. "Ran up to the house, and mother was not well," was a common report to the traveling orator, from whom she had just received letters from his stops in West Virginia and Pennsylvania. Receiving letters at hotels or post offices, Douglas learned in late April that Anna was sick with neurological attacks and had collapsed at the sink with vomiting spells, after which she seemed stupid. Rosetta summoned a doctor, and the malady was pronounced a bilious attack. Out on the hustings, where Douglas addressed audiences in town after town about the memory of the war, the character of republicanism, the right to vote, and the virtues of self-made men, came a steady stream of difficult domestic news and demands for financial assistance. Often exhausted, the self-made man soldiered on. That spring in 1867, Charles left his wife Libby living with Anna in Rochester and moved to Washington to take a job as a clerk at the Freedmen's Bureau, a position his father's connections made possible. Charles worked as a personal assistant to Oliver O. Howard, the director, writing his correspondence. The son was especially proud to tell his father that Charles was only the second colored man to be given a first-class clerkship. Charles seemed happy about his employment. His white co-workers were perfect gentlemen. He was, as always, though, worried about money. The boarding house rent was high, and he boldly asked his father for an $1,800 loan to buy a house. The elder Douglas rejected the request, beginning an exchange lasting for years over the financial dependency of his youngest son. Then came the news that Libby had delivered her baby on June 21st, a boy named Charles Frederick, who would always be known as Freddy. Writing as the stressed and absent father of his firstborn, Charles said he had no fears because Libby and the baby were in good hands. His mother had a great deal of experience by now with these joyous new additions to the Douglas family. Oddly, though, Charles said he was very well satisfied with the name you have given the boy. Apparently, as father, he had not participated in the choice. The women had taken care of that task, and though he addressed his letter to his father on June 21st, Douglas the elder was in Indianapolis, Indiana, speaking at Morrison's Opera Hall. That same summer of 1867, and for a decade to follow, the feud between Douglas's sons and his son-in-law, Nathan Sprague, festered and exploded. The quarrel began over money and loans between Frederick Jr., Charles, and Nathan, but eventually it descended into accusations of betrayal, lying, theft, and competing claims on the elder Douglas's property. Rosetta inevitably was caught between her brothers and her eventually estranged husband. Where Anna stood in all of this family warfare is hard to discern, but she likely defended her daughter, who remained her steady companion and nearby protector. Douglas himself tried to negotiate these treacherous waters and gave out some loans that he regretted as he traveled thousands of miles to make the livelihood necessary for these familial demands. In some letters to English friends, safely beyond the fray, he often told of recuperating from hard traveling and speaking, 10,000 miles and 100 speeches in a 3-month stretch. Like his three brothers-in-law, Sprague could not make a gainful living in Rochester. Repeatedly, he seemed to wear out his welcome at the Douglas household. Charles complained to his father of Nathan's alleged skullduggery. "I don't wish to trouble your mind about this affair between Nathan, Fred, and myself," Charles wrote in November 1867. "I know your mind and time are better occupied." But nothing stopped the flow of invective toward Nathan and Rosetta. "You may know the cause of the difficulty, but I know you don't know the whole truth, and it is hard to find it out under the circumstances." The mutual loathing between the brothers and Rosetta's husband and their feud were clearly over money and the elder Douglas's loyalty and largesse. Nathan, too, went west in search of a livelihood in 1868, leaving his wife and 2 children, ages 5 and 2, behind. From Omaha, Nebraska, he wrote directly to Douglas of his desperation for money and employment. Although racism lurked in his path at various junctures, one scheme after another of his failed. "I think I can make money here," wrote Nathan to his exasperated father-in-law, claiming he might open a boarding house for blacks. But soon he was back in Rochester, a ward of the old man's bank accounts and an embarrassment to his wife. From upper New England to the far Midwest, the road was undoubtedly a refuge for Douglas from all this family turmoil. But he could not escape it. Rosetta wrote to her father in Akron, Ohio, in early 1868, reporting that Nathan had left home for his western venture. This was the first of more than one marital separation for the Spragues, but Rosetta kept a stiff upper lip and pleaded her husband's case. She remained formally appreciative of all her father's kindness to Nathan and herself, but she confessed to being "sorry you have been obliged to form any unfavorable opinion, and hope you will not lose any of the confidence you have been pleased to keep in him, Nathan, for I believe and know it is Nathan's desire to act honorably." Those would turn out to be painfully unprophetic words. Sprague returned to Rochester within a year, but the situation only got worse. In February 1869, Rosetta told her father that his letters filled her with sadness. He had apparently drawn a line and declared that Nathan could no longer live on the hill, the Douglas house. Exasperation seemed to rule on both ends. "Douglas was free to choose," said Rosetta, "who you shall have around you, and I could stand all the grumbling and fault-finding that might arise by our remaining here." But she defended her husband's manly pride against Douglas's allegation that the unemployed son-in-law could not, exist without the Father's help. He took exception, complained Rosetta, to what you said, that it was all mouths and no hands, that you included him with the rest as being a burden. Douglas's cup of frustrations runneth over. The couple would move somewhere that Nathan could get employment as a gardener, she painfully wrote, if her husband could overcome his despondency. Pathetically, she said they did not wish to be any further indebted because of the many demands for money from you by all of the family. A month later, Rosetta wrote what had to be one of the most depressing letters Douglas ever received from his dysfunctional family. When he thought back to what his grandmother Betsy and his mother Harriet Bailey, for whom Rosetta's second child was named, had endured and survived, he surely felt a parent's despair. He could also vividly remember his own desperate experience of the early 1850s, when he was dependent on the largesse of Gerrit Smith and the fundraising of Julia Griffiths. Nathan still needed Douglas's approbation, Rosetta said. He needed to float free and escape all kinds of unkind remarks from the brothers. But the daughter desperately needed her father's compassionate heart. She felt cut off by her brothers, and she and Nathan could no longer tolerate their taunts. She tried to tell her father how much she loved and needed him, while at the same time she had to support her spouse. You say to me, husband's first and father's second, Rosetta wrote. I know it, but I cannot help it. My affection for you is of the warmest kind, and your words, whether of censure or praise, remain with me always and affect me accordingly. She was a 29-year-old woman in the middle of the 19th century, pregnant with her third child, married to a man who could not make a living, begging her father, a world-famous, heroic achiever who had conquered slavery, to stop, listen, and love her unconditionally. Rosetta was an intelligent, highly literate woman trapped in a cluster of gendered values she could never escape. And she had to feed her children. She needed material support. Between 1864 and 1877, Rosetta gave birth to 7 children with Sprague, 6 of them daughters, in a marriage that did manage to survive. Douglas deeply loved his daughter and had earlier cultivated her intellectual sensibilities, but now he did not hide his disappointments at her life choices. Rosetta became very personal in a way both tender and sadly self-pitying. A picture emerges from her perception of a father so consumed by his work and his cause that he could never see her dilemmas nor hear her cry. You say you are a lonely man, she said to Douglas with uncustomary directness. No one knows it better than myself. I felt it for years, for I have been in a measure lonely myself, but would not allow myself to analyze my feelings, as I was the daughter and had duties to fulfill in that relation. These are remarkable expressions in the era before psychology. Here was an adult woman saying, I did my duty as the daughter in our difficult home, as the oldest child and the go-between in the marriage made so troublesome by illiteracy and the frequently absent father and husband. I knew where my sympathies were, she informed Douglas. I do not know whether you thought much about it, having so many things to occupy your mind, but my position at home was anything but pleasant. Rosetta seemed to have stored up many feelings and a good deal of anger that she finally let fly at her father. You used often to say that we were all glad when you left, she continued, something that was so far from what was true as far as I was concerned. I never dared to show much zeal about anything where you were concerned, as I could never bear ridicule, and as jealousy is one of the leading traits in our family, I could very readily bring a storm about my ears if I endorsed any of your sentiments about matters pertaining to the household. Such a statement about Rosetta's youth at home reveals many realities. Anna Douglas's fierce grip on domestic affairs, Douglas's contradictory roles as both patriarch guest and absent father, the daughter's long emotional need to feel engaged with her father's public world, and a young woman's resentment as well as fascination for the 2 brilliant European women who had left such a mark on that household. Perhaps Rosetta's lament implied that she had become more of her mother than her father, and often wished it otherwise. She ended the letter with an agonizing admission. I do not wish to pain you, but I must say I have no pleasant remembrances of my brothers. I had my faults, no doubt, but none so great that their feelings of dislike should follow me to this day. As Douglas traveled the railroads of America, speaking to thousands about the great issues of Reconstruction, and plotted his career move to Washington, he awoke many days to the news that the home in Rochester festered with family conflict he simply could not resolve. And he was surely aware of his daughter's desperation for his love. While worshiping their father, the sons carried their own burdens of being Douglas's offspring. Each eagerly sought a father's love and approval. None of the Douglas sons achieved any further education after the war, nor did their father push them. Lewis, with some assistance from his brothers, began keeping scrapbooks about the elder Douglas, as well as about themselves. These scrapbooks eventually grew to at least 9 thick volumes collected over more than 3 decades. Their contents demonstrate that the brothers all shared great affection and solidarity among themselves. They even named their children for each other. As collectors of the details of their father's public life, they amassed newspaper clippings by the thousands. Eventually, in the 1880s, the family hired a clipping service, the American Bureau, which collected material from nearly everywhere the elder Douglas traveled. The scrapbooks were intended to be a record of fame and achievement, but sometimes they revealed more than the brothers may have intended. Lewis began collecting when he was in Denver in 1866-67. He was an aspiring journalist and printer, as well as an activist, like his father. Everywhere he, his brothers as well, went, comparisons to the famous father emerged, sometimes with blunt openness. Lewis helped organize a Denver meeting of blacks in 1867, celebrating the advent of the right of suffrage. He was recognized as a leader, but primarily as son of the old champion. He made a good chairman, said a reporter. His face bears clear marks of resemblance to that of his father. We think he will never take the proportions of the old warrior, but a survey of his face tells you that the son, like the sire, will grapple terribly with conflict. You feel he is a foeman worthy of his steel. The article then veered off into a litany of all the struggles and self-denials, tears and heart pangs, and the words hurled like avenging thunderbolts from Douglas himself that could somehow be seen in Lewis's face. Lewis wore his alleged attributes as a proud burden, at least most of the time. In 1869, he finally convinced his longtime sweetheart, Amelia Logan of Syracuse, to marry him. Their union was a long time coming, but tender. In December 1870, while living in Washington, Lewis jotted down a quick note to his beloved that he had to help Fred Jr. with an errand, then was going over to Charlie's, and hence it was the first meal I have missed with you since we were married. The Douglas brothers were family men. Lewis was a proud Army veteran and aspired in every way for his father's kind of dignity and self-assertion. But jobs and respect were not easily achieved for a young black man in post-Civil War America. While staying in Philadelphia in February 1868, Lewis joined a small group of a half dozen ladies and one gentleman on an ice skating excursion to Camden, New Jersey. He soon found himself surrounded by a number of white boys who objected to the good clothes worn by the young women and shouted racial insults. Lewis removed his skates and took on the white thugs with the blades, splitting one's head with the skates and severing another's thumb nearly off. He told the story to his fiancée, Amelia, with considerable bravado, and assured her that he had the praise of great coolness from his companions, especially the ladies. But coming at a peak in mob violence across the South by the Ku Klux Klan and other groups, this incident showed that a Douglas always had to be on guard. Lewis, like his father, was a brawler if he had to be. While in Colorado in 1867, Lewis published letters in the press asserting his, and by extension all blacks, loyalty and patriotism born of the war experience. There, and by 1869-70, After they moved to Washington, Lewis and Frederick Jr. got into an ugly conflict over membership in a printers' union. Since they could find no one in the all-white printers' union to sponsor them, they took work where they could get it. The federal government had greatly expanded since the war, and it made good sense to try to find employment in its bureaucracy. Frederick Jr. wrote to a Simon Wolfe of the Register of Deeds asking to be hired. He described himself as part of that despised class that had never before sought government positions. He had served his country during the war under the colors of Massachusetts, and he noted that he was the son of a man, Frederick Douglass, who was once held in bondage, protected by the laws of the nation, the perpetuity of which he and many of his race had struggled to maintain. Wolfe responded with encouragement, since he too was from a race equally maligned, Jews. Fred Jr. did not receive the job. In the summer of 1869, Lewis faced public accusation as a rat and working for unfair prices. He was denied membership in the Washington branch of the Columbia Typographical Union on account of his race. He protested. The dispute became a cause célèbre, and the elder Douglas forcefully defended his son in the national press as the representative of our whole people rising up from degradation to respectability. For the elder Douglas, the issue was clearly personal. He publicly denounced the shams and excuses used to deny Lewis membership, that his card had been improperly issued, and that he had willfully worked for lower wages. Douglas employed old abolitionist metaphors to skewer the scoundrels. They virtually say for the criminal that having cut off the ears of his victim, he has also the right to pluck out his eyes. Lewis was condemned for not joining a union whose racism prohibited his membership. Whether overt or covert, racism hurt to the soul. And Douglas let his friends and enemies know it. He brought the story home to Rochester. His goodly city had always welcomed him personally. Few other northern cities were as liberal and friendly to the colored race. But then he revealed a painful family tale to make the public argument. When Lewis returned from the war, wounded at the famous fight on the walls of Fort Wagner, and somewhat broken in health, the veteran was denied work at his trade. Week after week. Watching his son's demoralization made the elder Douglas feel the iron of Negro hate in his own soul. He especially felt wronged, because for 16 years on his own newspaper, he had hired white apprentices to the tune, by his count, of $100,000. That Douglas put a dollar figure on this particular kind of racism reflected the larger economic pain among his sons. He was telling whites that perhaps he was owed some interest on his investment in them. The problem of employment and financial rivalry continued unabated as well between Charles and Nathan and Rosetta. So eager was Charles to own a home in Washington that he audaciously asked his father to invest and help him buy a lot. Douglas sternly rebuked these overtures and urged his youngest to save his money, which only stimulated an aggrieved defensiveness on the part of the son. Charles outdistanced his sister for self-pity. "I had rather not have you lay out 1 cent in my behalf," Charles unconvincingly wrote to his father in 1868, "if you think that I am trifling with you and my money." He was doing his best and only hoped to benefit like the other clerks who have parents or friends to aid them. By fall 1868, Douglas had given Charles a new loan of at least $800, but the young man asked for $300 more to finish the roof on a house in a new black section of the district called Uniontown. Frederick Jr., too, had moved to the area and opened a store. Charles craved being wholly independent. His letters ached with such declarations as, "I will prove to you that my word will be kept. All I desire is to get into my house." Charles's money woes were more and more encased in nasty diatribes at Nathan. Douglas must have sighed and rolled his eyes in frustration as Charles carped about how he would never pay the money he owed to Nathan until Rosetta's husband paid up what he owed to Frederick Jr. The Douglas family exploded in sibling rivalry, poisoned by matters of money, status, and personality. In September 1868, Charles accused his father of bolstering up Nathan more than the brothers, moaning that the hated brother-in-law used to bring up his being better off than any of us boys, and acted as though he could get along and we could not. The racism of the outer world was bad enough. The elder Douglas agonized over the obnoxious drafts of human nature flowing from his kin, a situation suffused with both tragedy and farce. "I used to take it then," Charles whined, "but when I think over how he used to talk to me about Lou and Fred, it makes me angry." In 1869-70, exchanges between Douglas and Charles became private family warfare over integrity and inheritance. They even teemed with threats and conspiracy theories about the house on the hill in Rochester. Charles judged Nathan little more than an incompetent farmer who had let the Douglas family cow die. Worse, Charles thought Nathan an unfaithful husband and a thief with designs on Douglas's estate. "I have no friendship for Sprague," Charles declared in February 1869. Sprague's misrepresentations had forced me and the other boys to be sent away. This may have struck Douglas as absurd, but the despairing Charles, who lost his job at the Freedmen's Bureau in March and occasionally received a $100 draft from his father to keep him afloat, complained bitterly of being, in his view, closed out of the family. "Sprague has the advantage of mother, and if mother wants a letter written, she has to go to Rosetta, and there it goes, and you only get one side of what transpires." This was no news to Douglas about the ways communications to and from Anna were accomplished, but it was depressing to read these missives from his dependent adult son. Moreover, in Washington, the employment of the Douglas brothers became increasingly a matter of public debate. Charles eventually landed a job as a clerk in the Treasury Department. "Such pets are the Douglas family," said one complaint in the press, "that they seem to think themselves entitled to the lion's share of choice offices. Therefore, the honor and respect of the white people are bruised and outraged hereby." Charles and his brothers were Douglas's eyes in Washington. The youngest son was an astute observer of congressional and presidential politics. In February 1870, Charles attended the swearing-in of Hiram Revels of Mississippi, the first African-American member of the U.S. Senate. Charles informed his father that he heard it whispered several times in the galleries that people wished it were Douglas himself being sworn in. Charles urged the orator to take aim at the Congress and cease the killing tours through the West, one of which was underway that very moment in Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, Michigan, and Ohio. Charles's life in Washington was not all consumed in seeking government jobs and observing politics. During the 5 years after the war, he was directly involved in organizing two black baseball teams, the Alert and the Mutual Baseball Clubs. Charles's embrace of baseball likely began in the Army during the war. He also played second base for a Rochester team, the Excelsior Club, as early as summer 1865. For a while in 1867, he played for the Union Baseball Club and reported to his father in August that the team had played an out-of-town game against the Philadelphia Pythians. The elder Douglas invested in and attended some games, but did not participate. In the wake of the Civil War, baseball boomed in popularity in the capital, as well as in many other cities, especially in the North. All the rules of the American pastime were by no means settled in the 1860s. It was played with a bat, a ball, no gloves, and four bases. Foul lines were still evolving, but teams played with nine men. In this offense-favored game, a winning team's scoring 100 runs on a weaker opponent was not uncommon. Baseball boomed in Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, and in Richmond, where teams of ex-Confederates played teams of ex-Union soldiers with the theme of sectional reunion already awkwardly in the air, even as early as 1866-67. For Charles, and for so many of the other young government workers, black and white, baseball was a personal and community outlet. The war was over, and despite the tremendous political conflicts of Reconstruction, Washington was a burgeoning new city with nearly 40,000 black residents and over 88,000 whites. Black baseball clubs, not unlike fraternal orders and churches in black communities, took on a social-political function. In these years, the goal was never to gain full integration into white teams and leagues, but to achieve full access to the best playing grounds and to book matches with the best clubs, such as the famed Washington.